Hockey and music go hand in hand. I mean, you can't even start a game if you don't have a hard pumping song to get you going. And of course, the music for the Mother Puckers openings and closing song, Havoc by Sean Tubbs, sounds even better thanks to J-Rocket Audio Design's pedals. For you hockey moms out there who also have guitar players, there's no better pedal on the market to help your budding Jeff Beck sound like Jeff Beck than with the JB Archer from J-Rocket Audio Designs or any of the many award-winning pedals produced by them. Other than the sound, the best part is they are made in the USA. All you have to do is go to rocketpedals.com. That's with two T's, R-O-C-K-E-T-T, pedals, P-E-D-A-L-S.com, to hear and see the products, find distributors, and enjoy the website experience. And if you purchase a pedal from JRAD, please use the code PUCKERS because that is going to get you 10% off of your purchase. And I will personally thank you on my podcast. And when your little player plays himself a little song or records it, send it on in. I'll make a compilation and put them all out on the podcast in the future. Thank you to J-Rocket Audio Designs for being the first Mother Puckers sponsor. Welcome to Mother Puckers, the first and only podcast for hockey moms by a hockey mom. And that's me, Julie Bardowski, alongside the hockey apostle and the 13th disciple, Lou Mangialuzzo. Welcome to the show. Today, Mother Puckers, I am bringing you a wonderful treat that is a great example of a Minnesota hockey story. Born and raised in the state of hockey, Lance Pitlick played high school for Robbinsdale Cooper and was drafted in 1986's early entry draft by the hometown North Stars, who got stolen by Dallas, going on to play his style of tough physical play as a defenseman for the University of Minnesota Golden Gophers from 1986 to 90, wearing the C on his jersey a senior year. He played 144 career games with 39 points after college. He was signed by the Philadelphia Flyers, played with their minor league affiliate, the Hershey Bears of the AHL, for 4 years. Then in 1994, he signed with the Ottawa Senators, where he played for 7 seasons, two of which were for the AHL's Prince Edward Island Senators. In 1996, he scored a career-high 10 points and 91 penalty minutes. We're going to have a little conversation about that. From Ottawa, he turned in the snow and cold, moved south for palm trees and beaches with the Florida Panthers. Played 3 years with the Panthers before retiring in 2002. Since then, he has been busy raising two boys with his wife, Lisa, back in Plymouth, Minnesota, and started a company called Sweet Hockey, where he's developed products and programs to help youth and NHL players improve their game. So welcome to Mother Puckers, Lance. I'm so glad to have you.
Thanks for having me. This is quite a treat. Happy to be a part of it.
Great. Well, so how are things up in Minnesota during this crazy COVID kind of lockdown, not lockdown time for you guys?
You know, for when we had the mandatory lockdown, I do private lessons, working on stick handling and shooting with players at my house, as you know. I had your boy there last week.
Yep.
So it really hasn't changed for me. I wish I could do more hours of lessons because there's definitely a demand with the players since not much, you know, now that they're skating, it's lightened up a little bit. But, you know, for us, we're just being careful. And my boys haven't been around. They've been working down in Florida with a trainer down there. So they're actually my son, my oldest one, who is with Nashville, he's heading your way tomorrow or Sunday. He's got a report to Nashville. So he gets an opportunity to maybe get a game in the playoffs. So we'll see what happens there. So yeah, things are good here and looking forward to having a fun, relaxing 4th of July.
Oh, that's nice. Well, so wait, you didn't have the boys with you during this time, so you weren't facing the same full household as a lot of people were. So good for you. Nice, relaxing 4th of July. Are you going to be going up to your cabin?
We were up here last night and the air conditioning went out, so we ended up driving back home, but after I'm done with you, we're going to head back because we got a tech that's going to come out and fix it today, so he's going to save the day for us, so we're going to be back up at the cabin later this afternoon.
Good for you. Good for you guys. Well, I would love to dig into your playing career. I mean, I listed it all out up there, but tell me, what helped propel you to such a great career at the U? I mean, from youth all the way up, like, what got you there?
You know what? If you would look at me as a youth player and even a high school player, everyone thinks of someone that makes it to the NHL that they're, you know, a point getter. And I never really was. I had a niche for being very physical, and I could, you know, look for opportunities where players would have their head down and have some big hits. So I carved out a niche for myself, and most people don't know my senior year, I only played a few games. My senior year, I had that sports hernia. And back then, you know, I should have been out 6 weeks, but they didn't know what it was. So I was out for like 5 months. You know, that was my senior year. So that wasn't easy. And then you had mentioned that I was drafted by the North Stars, and how do I get to Philadelphia? Well, that was the year before I was was eligible to sign. That's when the Minnesota North Stars and San Jose Sharks had that split of the team, and they didn't want to put a signing bonus, what they told me. Put a signing bonus into a player that they might lose, so they just released me. And the guy that actually got me drafted with the North Stars was now with Philadelphia. So my agent called him, and within 24 hours, they had the same contract on the table. So that's how I got to Philadelphia. But yeah, I was, you know, I'm a heart and soul guy. I love killing penalties, blocking shots, playing physical, and, you know, just getting the puck to players that know what to do with it, because I didn't very well.
Well, we'll get to talk about how you changed that for sure. So, yeah, and, you know, how do you watch the game? Because it's really changed from big hits to softer hits. And, I mean, you know, the physicality of the game back when you played it, because it was very physical back then, and it's obviously changed. How have you helped your sons adapt to that? I mean, how are you like, gosh, come on, take a hit or give a hit, and they won't do it?
Yeah, well, it's like, it's been an evolution, you know. Once concussions kind of came to the forefront, and, you know, people started seeing, you know, what fighting did and what blows to the head would do to players in all sports that have physicality. You know, you take a look at it, and safety becomes a big concern. And, you know, from when I retired and I got into coaching, you know, you see so many kids that are putting themselves in really vulnerable positions once checking starts, because they don't have the stick skills in order to have the confidence to have their eyes up when they're coming up the ice and going into high traffic areas. So I knew as a player at the end of every year when I was playing, you know, in pro hockey in the NHL, you have an exit meeting with your coaches and trainers, and they'd give you your summer workout program. And I'm not kidding you, Julie, every single coach suggested to me, hey, if there's one thing you could do this summer is work on your hands. And I was, you know, I'd sit there like, all right, do you got a book for me to follow? Because the internet wasn't going back then.
No, we had dial-up barely.
Yeah. So, yeah, you know, I shot some pucks, but I didn't know how to develop stick handling skills or anything like that. So, you know, when I got into coaching, and I knew nothing about coaching, I didn't know how to teach a 4-year-old how to skate or handle a puck or pass. But if you played in the NHL and you got a kid that wants to play hockey, guess what? You got a coach. So I became a student of the game again, and dove into it. I got every DVD, book, article that I could find on how to best develop hockey players for the long term. And, you know, I put a lot of time into it. You know, I dedicated the last pretty much 20 years to learning how to teach players, you know, how to get better and what they need to have implemented into their life if they have lofty goals. I mean, if they just want to play hockey and at the end of the season they put their bag away, that's a different, you know, story.
Yeah.
But if a kid wants to play college hockey, wants to play on the top teams in their association area, then, you know, there's certain steps and a heck of a lot of enormous repetitions go into it. So that's kind of what I've developed into, and I'm still learning and developing new content every day, and it's fun because I get to be in front of a lot of really, really passionate, successful hockey players, and I can make them frustrated. So that's good.
It's always fun. Well, so frustrating, going back to that sports hernia your senior year, how did you handle that? Because you're wearing the captaincy, so you're their leader. You know, how did you handle that not being able to play? How are you still able to be that leader of that team and influencer?
You know, anytime you have injuries, you always feel like you're on an island of the misfit hockey players.
Right.
You know, you're a round peg trying to get into a square hole, and it's awkward. But, you know, that was a lot of beers ago, Julie. So I guess I remember. So it's ironic because my wife was a gymnast at Minnesota, and I got hurt, and I think she blew out her knee a few weeks later.
Oh.
So she was done for the year. And I think the two of us, you know, wobbling around trying to get to class, we spent a lot of time talking about that stuff. And, you know, when you're hurt, it sucks. There's no way about it. But the team does their best to, you know, keep you engaged. But as far as from a leadership standpoint, I kind of had to step aside and let others kind of do it, because a big part of it is, you know, the time you spend on the ice sweating and, you know, banging and preparing for battle. And, you know, but I have, you know, great memories. I mean, the University of Minnesota was an awesome experience. It was everything I'd hoped it'd be when I went there. And, you know, I was lucky to be able to play after that for a while, too.
Well, so it sounds like injuries can lead to romance. So there's that upside, huh?
No, yeah.
Well, you know, it's funny that you talk about the U, because my dad, my mom, my cousin, my uncle, all Gophers. So my cousin even spent a couple years as Goldie. So the U's been around me my whole life. And of course, my dad keeps trying to convince our son that the U should be his first choice to play hockey if he can get there, which of course would be absolutely amazing. But when you were there, what are some of your favorite memories?
Oh, you know, we got to the Final Four, 3 out of the 4 years that we were there. Thanks for bringing this up, too. We lost in the national championship in 89 to Harvard in double overtime. So
that's funny, because my son's first choice. He wants to go to Harvard.
Yeah, good, good. Well, I always tell
double
the players.
Wow.
Yeah. I always tell the players, you know, I ask them the first time that I have a lesson with a player, you know, what do they want from hockey? And if they say, I want to play college hockey, I ask them where. And a lot of players don't know. They just want to play college, but you got to get more specific. And for my situation, how I ended up in Minnesota, they were the only ones that really showed any interest. I went there on a half scholarship, not a full ride, and earned a full scholarship, you know, after my first year. But I've never had an easy road. Like I mentioned, I'm not overly skilled, but I'm not going to get outworked, and I'm not going to, you know, no one's going to outthink me or prepare. And that's a big part of, you know, passing people and continuing to play longer than most.
Oh yeah. Being a grinder and the hardest worker, that's so key. I mean, there's so many players that, you know, like you, that you see that have just outworked everybody else. They don't let the distractions take them away from what their goals are. So that's a really good example. Your PIMS were pretty high there in the pros for that year. How did that feel?
Well, yeah, I had one coach that played for a team you may recognize, the Minnesota Fighting Saints.
Yes.
A long, long time ago. And that was, you know, like Slapshot. It was fights every game. And he told me after I was going into my fifth year playing pro hockey, he says, "Hey, if you want to make it, just go out and fight every game for a while until you do." And that's what I did. I went and started fighting and didn't do very well. Got my butt kicked a lot, but ended up, you know, being an everyday player. First, I got up there, you know, I was a healthy scratch a lot, and then, you know, get some games. And I think it was my third year in Ottawa. This is how I stuck, is I made it out of camp as the seventh defenseman. And then I think it was our fifth game we were playing in New Jersey, and two of our defensemen in the same game blew out their knee and they were out for the year. Mm. So all of a sudden I go from number seven to five. I play the rest of the year there and then signed another contract with them, and it was a one way. And that pretty much tells you that you're going to be in the NHL for that point on. And that's what happened.
Oh, wow. And how did it feel though when you did get that draft and that contract, you know, whether it was the from the Flyers to the Senators and then with Florida? I mean, that had to be like a dream come true, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, it was. I always told my wife, I just want a couple things. I want one game in the NHL and a hockey card, and I'd be happy with that. And we turned it into a career. And but every contract was, I was like, I guess I don't have to work like the rest of the world does for another few years. And I just kept on doing that until I couldn't do it anymore.
So then since you separated yourself, you know, you made yourself that role player, you know, tough man. What was your favorite fight or hardest fight or both?
So we were playing, it was my first time that I was going to be playing in Minnesota against the Wild. I'd never played against the Wild because they didn't have a team for a while. So we were playing in Colorado the night before, and someone ran one of my teammates. I think it was Len Barry, and I was close to him. So I got in there, and it was the first fight that I was just, things just kind of slowed down. You know, I was like, all right, I got this. And I had my right arm free. So I going to throw my first punch, completely miss him, and I hit the glass.
Oh,
and two of my fingers, I couldn't lift them, like move them up. So I ended up just, you know, grabbing on and trying to wrestle them down. And so I got down, and long story short is I didn't have to have surgery, but I was out for about a month because I screwed up some ligaments. But then, so when I went to the doctor, I go, "Hey doc, yeah, that's good news on that hand." I said, "This hand's hurting like heck." So I ended up, because I'm, you know, I don't give up much and I'm stupid. But when I wrestled him down, one of my fingers got caught up in his jersey, and I broke my finger in half. Like, I snapped it. And so I was a mess for a while. So I went to Minnesota the next day, you know, both hands all wrapped up, and I had like 70 people coming. I called my mom. I said, "Tell everyone they're not coming because I'm not playing." So anyways, it was that was the one fight that I, like I said, I felt really comfortable, and it just had the worst results.
Oh, that's terrible. So you were in the era of like Tony Twist and those guys. Did you and Tony ever square off?
Oh no, they're at a different level. I was a middleweight at best and not a very good one. I mean, I fought because I had to. I didn't like it. Didn't like it at all, but you know, the job requires some things. And you know, for a player that's not in the, you know, top two lines or top set of defensemen, you know, you can't take anything for granted. And you know, for me being in and out of the lineup so much early in my career, I knew when I got a roster spot that I was going to do everything in my power to keep it. So that requires doing things that aren't comfortable all the time.
Oh, you know what? I'm going to circle back to that when we start talking about your program, because that was the thing that stood out to me that you said last week to my son, because you truly can't get better unless you become uncomfortable. You just can't. Yeah, Twister was quite the monster, that's for sure. That is a bad result to have two broken fingers and your family and friends can't come and watch you. You're really the first person that I've had the opportunity to and share with the listeners about what youth hockey is like in the state of hockey, aka Minnesota. And I'll tell you what, our week there last week just it opens your eyes to a whole different world, because when you're not in it, it's a very quiet, there's almost like this wall between Minnesota and the rest of the states around hockey. It's a very quiet knowledge share. And I learned so much, but maybe you can share, you know, what is it like to grow up there and play there? And obviously play for the U is huge, but you know, what's it like as a youth player, you know, playing pond hockey, all that fun stuff that we hear about?
Yeah, I mean, that was, I grew up right across the street from an outdoor rink. So I just put my skates on, skate guards, walk across, and I'd be there all the time. And that was, once my kids showed an early passion for hockey, that was something that, you know, was important to me to make sure that they experienced something similar. So the house that we currently live in, there's a pond right next to it, and my wife loved the house. I loved the pond, and that's why we bought the house. And, you know, so that was during the winter. I had the rink manager uniform on, and, I mean, I spent a lot of time out there for my boys and their buddies to have that same experience. So it is crazy. I mean, it's the weather's not like it was when I was a kid. You know, it was hard to maintain an outdoor rink, but they definitely put the hours in and had fun out there. But, you know, Minnesota hockey, from the outside, you look at it, you know, and from at that point, yes, I can go any direction from my house 10 minutes and I could run into a different hockey rink. Ugh. And not just one rink, but multiple rink facilities. So every community has their own rink, and the league is, you know, for us, the high school league's probably what makes it the most special, is, you know, because players grow up playing community based hockey with their buddies, and they all the way up to the high school level to where they dream of getting to the Excel, where the Wild play for the state high school hockey tournament. And that building will be packed all weekend watching, you know, the best teams in the state of Minnesota play for the championship. And that's on TV. And, you know, it's just like now Nashville. There's kids that watch the Nashville Predators and dream of playing for that team someday.
Yeah, you're right. Well, that state high school hockey championship is the number one youth hockey game in the world.
Well, there you go. Yeah, so it's big time.
It is.
So yeah, it's different, but you know, you look at there's associations in northern Minnesota that might have a population of, you know, 1,500, and they make it down there and they win the tournament, you know, over these city kids. And then everyone's trying to crack the code of a community called Edina.
Oh yeah. The powerhouse.
Yeah. You know, and you talk about, they don't tip their hands. They continuously develop players. But, you know, I think a real important thing to their success or any successful community-based program is a lot of coaches that have gone on to play in college or pro hockey, both boys and girls, come back and, you know, coach at the youth levels when they have kids and even when they don't have kids. And that recycling of these successful hockey players back into the program really helps out. And I know when I lived down in Florida, hockey was starting to grow, and now a lot of players that played for the Panthers, even I know in Dallas, that they have resided there in retirement and started hockey training businesses similar to what I've done, where they're training athletes both on and off the ice. working on skills.
It's interesting how it has become prolific for those players to stay in the towns where they were. I mean, a ton of Blues stay in St. Louis. Like you mentioned, a ton of Stars stay in Dallas. And in Florida, we actually went to a camp a couple, 3 years ago down there, and we had Jovanovski on the ice. We had Krivokraska on the ice coaching these boys. It's phenomenal how readily the NHL players give back to the community of hockey.
Yeah. It's been our life's passion and work. And, you know, a lot of players that I played with, they went the major junior route in Canada or played over in Europe. And, you know, they didn't go to college and they don't have a college education. So when they're done, you know, that was their education, hockey. And pass it on and show what you learned and help others, you know, try to do the same thing you did, play as long as you can.
It's pretty cool. I just don't see that in other sports. You know, you don't see NFLers or Major League Baseball guys really getting out there to the level that I have witnessed NHL players giving back. That's cool. And like, heck, we ran into Matt Cullen, who's coaching his all three boys teams now up in Moorhead, and he used to be here with the Predators, so we got to know them at that time because our boys played together. But yeah, again, another example that once he's done, he's now, you know, out there coaching his kiddos. So a little statistic that I think goes along right now with what we're talking about around Minnesota, it truly feels like coming from that state is the best opportunity for hockey. There's currently 50 NHLers coming from Minnesota, and 25% of men and women Division I scholarship holders come from Minnesota. The next closest state is Michigan, and it's almost half that number. So what are you guys putting in the water up there that is, other than freezing it, that is just making it? I mean, you have 236 rinks. The next closest state is, I think, Massachusetts with 100 or 98 or something. So obviously access to ice is huge. But what else do you think makes it such a place to breed these successful hockey players?
So I'll tackle this way. I will say in the easiest terms that they do what I call extras. And extras are what's in addition to your team practices and games for your winter team and your spring, summer. So this, you'll find this interesting. So this winter was the first time that I didn't coach a team in 17 years. And I was always curious about puck possession. So back in 2002 at the Salt Lake City Olympics and the youth national tournaments that season, USA Hockey conducted the most comprehensive game puck possession study to date, where at the Olympics and the tournaments, they would pick a couple players from each game they were watching that they thought were going to be, you know, impact players, and then they would just track how long they had the puck in their stick for the game. So it didn't matter what level of play, it was pretty consistent that it's right around 1 minute in games. And what people have to understand is that as you get older and you're playing high school or, you know, U18, college hockey, pro hockey, where if you're not on the first two lines, you're not on the power play or penalty kill, your ice time goes way down. So, you know, you might, like for me, I might on a good day, a good game, have the puck on my stick 30 seconds in a game, if that. But in most games, you know, it was probably 15, 20 seconds, and I just get the puck and I move it. That's it. I get it, move it. So we know that in games, that's not where you develop. And this is all about, you know, developing stick skills. How do you develop high-end stick skills? So I was interested in my practices, how long players had the puck in their stick, because I thought I was a pretty good skills guy. I was very prepared for practices, but I never had the time to do it. So I did that this winter. I went to a bunch of local rinks around the area, and I actually had a high school kid doing some filming for me as well. And we would just get to practice early, and I covered every level of hockey, from mites all the way up to high school, boys and girls. I got samples from every level, both sides. And we'd just go there, pick a player that got on the ice early, and just film him or her the whole practice. And then I'd cut up the video to where they just had the puck in their stick. So what we found in all of our studies is that the longest sample that I had was 7 minutes and 11 seconds. And I had two samples that were just under 2 minutes of having the puck in your stick, you know, coming up the ice, shooting, whatever. That it averaged out to just over 4 minutes. So I can conclusively, you know, to the whatever my study is, it's, I mean, it's not overly scientific, but, you know, I'm in the trenches, is that in games, in 2 hours of ice time, you only possess the puck 5 to 6 minutes. And if you want to develop high-end hands, you got to find ways to do more. And most people don't have the ability to have unlimited ice, you know, to get a few hours each week,
right,
of more ice time. So you got to go find other, you know, areas. So you go find a skills instructor to get more hours. And how do you develop hands? It starts early. Believe it or not, I believe that knee hockey is the first thing that they encounter, where they're getting the stick in their hand and they're manipulating a ball or a puck. And then there's street hockey, roller hockey. There's working with an off-ice skills guy like me, working on your skills, or it's doing it yourself at home. So, you know, if you look at Minnesota, again, 10 minutes any direction from my house, there's going to be a rink. And guess what? In that rink, there's going to be someone that does skills training on the ice. And most of the rinks, a lot of them, I mean, that's kind of the thing rinks are doing now, is putting in off-ice areas,
right,
you know, in the corner of the rink. So kids get to do that. So there's skills guys at all these rinks that players can access and utilize. And then I don't know how many external facilities that are out there that people train out of warehouses, you know, where they're offering stick skill stuff. So I just think that there's a lot more opportunity for extra things players can do to get more repetitions, either on the ice or off the ice, skating and working on the stick skills. You know, we just have way more of those things here than in other places.
No, I think you're exactly right. Just in that week, last week, and talking to the people that I spoke to up there and meeting you, that difference is obviously the ice time availability, and that it's everywhere and it's a culture, but it's the availability of these resources that it's unbelievable. There's truly nothing like what you're doing, say here in Nashville, and we've got an NHL team. So imagine if you're playing hockey in a city that doesn't have an NHL team affiliated with it, having those resources is going to be even less so. So I think that sounds like it's the magic. It's the ice and the skills development that's the opportunity up there for the kids to just get there and go where they want to go.
Yep. And there's like specific to the Twin Cities area. You know, I've been in this business for almost probably 14 years, and there's guys that and gals that are been doing it probably 10 years before I was, but we're all still doing what we do. So it's we refer people to different. I'm training a player that needs some work on skating, I got two or three instructors I'll throw their way.
Yeah,
you know,
that's
so
amazing.
But yeah, it's educating. Playing in the NHL definitely gives kids of NHL players a competitive advantage, because, you know, we know what it takes to get to that level, and we know all the steps. And the most important thing we know is that you got to have patience, because this takes time.
Right.
And, you know, in this instant gratification society we live in, a lot of kids don't have patience. They want it yesterday, you know. So it's trying, you know, what I tried to do as a coach is to just educate players that it's a slow drip, and that these small weekly positive gains that we're making, mm-hmm, over time will be very impactful, you know, on your long-term career. And they have to see a return on their investment. What's the ROI?
Right.
So if I'm working with a kid on the ice and he can't stop one way, well, I'm going to get him feeling good about what we're doing on the ice, to where at the end of the day, he's like, I just got a little better. and that's good. Yeah. And then let's do the same thing tomorrow, and then we'll do it again tomorrow. So, yeah, it's and what's awesome, Julie, is that I am still learning new things about the game and how to just help players regardless of whatever it is that's going on with them. And, you know, there's just a lot of really creative and unique people that are out there in the hockey world that have been super open in sharing what they've developed or learned.
That's amazing. So, and that just kind of drives me right into, you know, the next part that I want to talk to you about. And, you know, you have two sons that both grew up in Minnesota, both D1 players with early entry drafts. You guys are basically the Minnesota version of the Kachucks out of St. Louis. So, you know, having a Gopher and an NHL dad in Minnesota, your boys kind of didn't have a choice for hockey, did they? Or they were led by it, right?
Well, I actually went, yes, and thank you. It's a heck of an accomplishment for them. I think I actually, when my oldest Rem was going through the process, he had Minnesota, St. Cloud, North Dakota, Duluth, and Mankato, I think. So all the Minnesota schools. And he went, you know, and visited all of them. And I thought that his best fit would have been North Dakota. But at the end of the day, I always tell the players, to say, what do you want your college experience to be? You know, when they don't know where they want to go and they're lucky enough to have a few different options, it's what do you want your experience to be? And he decided, you know what, Dad, because he went to Shattuck and then he played. So he was living out of the house, I think, when he was 14, and then went to Shattuck for 3 years and then played in the USHL for two. So he was gone. He just says, you know what? I want to be close to home. So that's why he chose Minnesota, because he has a good relationship with his younger brother. And I think he wanted to be able to see him play once in a while and be a part of his life. So we were happy as a family. It was awesome. So here's what's interesting. I didn't know this. In all the years, which has been the Gophers have been, this is their 100th year, I think, season coming up. In all those 100 seasons, Rem and myself are the first two Gophers that went on to play, you know, at least one game in the NHL. Out of all Minnesota, we're the two. So if my youngest plays for Minnesota, which he's will in another year, if he makes it to the NHL, then I think we got that category locked down.
Yeah, you do. That is maroon and gold all over the place there. Well, you know, you brought up Rem, and I'm going to list out just a few of these accomplishments. So bear with me, because I want our listeners to hear about your firstborn son, then we'll talk about your secondborn son. Okay, so 2016 USA Hockey Dave Tyler Junior Player of the Year, 2016 USHL Player of the Year, 89 points in 56 games were a single season record. 46 goals were the third most all-time in the USHL Tier 1 era. Now let's go to his freshman year at the U. Named to the Big Ten All-Freshman Team, skated in 36 games as a rookie for the Gophers, notched 32 points, 14 goals, 18 assists, to finish tied for fifth on the team in scoring and first among rookies, named Minnesota's Frank Pond Rookie of the Year. Let's move on to the sophomore year. Skated in all 38 games for the Gophers, led them with 31 points, 12 goals, 19 assists, 11 power play points, 12 goals were tied for the team lead, academic all Big Ten and a Big Ten Distinguished Scholar, AHCA All-American Scholar. Junior year, first team All-America selection, first team all Big Ten, skated in all games for the Gophers, led them in scoring for the second year in a row with 45 points. Academic All Big Ten, earned Minnesota's John Mariucci Most Valuable Player Award and Mike Krupe Most Determined Player Award. Signed a 2-year entry level contract with the Preds after the junior season. He forwent his final year with the Gophers, but he became the 121st Gopher hockey alum to play in the NHL. When he debuted last March, which we've gotten to see down here. We've seen him in the gold helmet here in Nashville, and he's a great asset for the Preds, so that's very cool. So my questions are, of that list of accomplishments, and that's only partially of his list. What's the most meaningful to you as a dad?
Oh, great question. And it's going to be different than what I think you would think. What I'm most proud of him is his survival years. Before all of those accomplishments happened, he did it probably till his first year Bantam. So, I mean, he was dominant as a youth player. But he was little. He was just tiny. There's a player that plays on the Minnesota Wilds. Oh, what is his name?
Kevin Fiala?
No, it's a player that he played with at Shattuck. Anyways, these two guys, this guy was like 6'4" as a batter.
Oh, geez.
And Rem was, you know, like 5'3", and just a peanut. But they lit it up. I mean, they each had over, you know, 120 points, I think. And then after that year, he was just small and he was scared. And I call those the survival years. So he won a national championship his third year at Shattuck, and he was a non-factor. I mean, I don't even think he got a point in there. And then he went to the USHL his senior year, and he played 46 games, and I think he got 16 points. So, you know, people are starting to wonder, did the Gophers make a good choice? And it was hard, but he was his first year in the USHL, he was 168 pounds. And how I describe it is that if he was in front of the net with a defenseman and the puck was in the corner and he went, you know, it was those two guys, him and that defenseman, that were going to go in the corner and get the puck, he would never be the first guy there. He'd get there, but he'd never be the first guy there, and he'd never come out with the puck. You know, he was scared. So that year he ended up breaking his arm at the end of the season, so he came home and he hit his growth spurt. And he went in the following year at 195 pounds, a little more junk in the trunk.
Yeah.
And started off kind of slow, but then he just took off. And, you know, so what I'm most proud of is that he stuck with it when he was in some, you know, really difficult situations at times. And, you know, he battled through it. And, you know, believe me, every player that I get in front of, they're competitors. And if you've had a taste of success and you can't have that anymore, it seems like you can't have it anymore, it's hard. So that type of persevering and going through that, you know, I can't teach it. And it just killed my wife to watch him go through it, because I wasn't viewing it as a parent. I was viewing it as a hockey guy, knowing that these times suck. But long term, if you can punch through, you're going to be so much stronger. And, you know, he started having success, getting his confidence back, and, you know, he just went for it. Because I always told him that keep your feet moving and don't put yourself in a position to get blown up and survive this time, because once it's going to be a level playing field, or a lot more level once you get closer to your adult body. And because you've had to take four strides to one, you know, a bigger player's one stride for the last 4 years, you're gonna catch them now, and you're gonna pass them, and that's what happens. So, you know, it's just hanging in there, and knowing that that's one of the feelings or experiences that every player will go through, and some of them suck, you know, but you have to go through them, and no one's immune to them, and if you can just punch through, you know, get to the other side, that's where the fun stuff starts to happen.
Yeah, it seems that the people who have to grind it out, you know, who aren't, you know, necessarily gifted with everything from birth all the way through, those are the ones that actually want it more and go after it. So that's cool. And, you know, I can totally empathize, you know, with your wife, because I also know, as a high level gymnast myself, what it takes to get to that level. It's a lot. And the fact that she can be an ally with you, knowing how hard you have to work to get to the goals and the dreams that you have, I think that the two of you have a really good balance for your kids. So Rhett, you know, he hasn't made it to the U yet. He's spending some time playing in Nebraska for the Lancers, but he seemed to have made a name for himself at Chaska. And I imagine with the family bloodline in him, his honors are going to be very similar to his big brother's. Do they play similarly, or is there a difference in their playing?
No, they're different, but you know, they're both considered, you know, skill guys, I would say. And so, yeah, he went to, there was a player that I played with at Minnesota named Dave Snuggerud, and him and another hockey guy, Andy Brink, they started a hockey academy down there at Chaska. And at that time, my son was struggling in school. So we were looking for alternatives to public school, and this came up. So I ended up helping. It was the first year that they opened, so I ended up helping Dave and Andy. They needed 15 students to open it up. So I think my son and five others that I kind of talked to went down there for school for 3 years. And from that point on, that's where, again, they were on the ice most days, and they got a lot of extras. And that school alone, I mean, they have, I think this will be their fifth or sixth year, they got to have over 20 players that are committed to Division One. Andy Brink's son, he played at Denver this past season. Oh, wow. But yeah, so he went to Chaska, and we had, you know, just a great group of players and coaches. So it was an awesome time there. He left his senior year to play for Omaha, and then he got traded to Muskegon, Michigan. And that's where he'll be playing one more season before he goes into the U. So he's, he sees his brother and everything that he accomplished. And, you know, as a younger sibling, he wants to crush it.
Yeah.
You know, he wants to beat him. So that's one of the, I forget what book it was, but there was a study done, and I found this very interesting. There was a study done on the world's fastest sprinters, and they wanted to see, you know, were there some commonalities. And the one that stuck out the most was that not one of the world's fastest sprinters were ever firstborns. They were all, you know, second or third, fourth siblings. So they always had the older one they were chasing. So
wow.
That's,
so yeah, there's cool. An older Bolt. I didn't know that Usain Bolt had an older brother. Or sister.
Yeah,
that's cool. Well, that's like the Joyner sisters. There you go. And Serena, yeah, and Venus. Yeah, that's interesting. Very interesting. Well, so I sure hope that they get to start their season and get a full season in so that they can continue that path. But this virus, oh my goodness, it's just got to go away so that everybody can go about and use their skills and talents. What do you think of both hub cities for the playoffs being in Canada?
You know what? I haven't given it much thought at all, to be honest with you.
I'm a little frustrated as a U.S. citizen.
Yeah. Yeah. No, summer times are my my busiest, so I pretty much disconnect from the world. And it's just a lot of work now with business and online marketing, you know, having to create videos for Instagram and YouTube. It's just... Mm-hmm. It's just a lot more work, and I haven't even got into the podcast game yet, and I'm sure that's coming.
It should come, and here's your debut. You mentioned that your son's work with some other coaches. Who are some of those? Did you mentioned Adam Oates, right?
Yep, yep. They've been currently down in Florida training with him. My older boy is a buddy of his as well, who plays at Harvard, has been down there, so. You know, they're much like, you know, what's going on in the pandemic. So let's talk about that for a second.
Yeah.
You know, from a hockey player perspective. So once players couldn't skate, then a lot of them started looking for alternatives to get better at hockey. And they may not have spent much time doing off-ice stick handling and shooting, but they started doing that. Okay. So boys, both of them had similar paths where they were little and, you know, they struggled for a few years. But what was constant was that they were always working on their stick skills. And during the pandemic here, now some players started doing the off-ice stuff. Some already had implemented that, Now, fast forward to where they get back on the ice after a long break, which happened to be the longest break for every hockey player in the world.
Ever. Yes.
Ever. Which is a good thing.
Yeah.
But now that they're skating again, the majority of them now stopped doing the off-ice stuff.
Oh.
But the ones that you see scoring on a regular basis in games make that a priority. And they continue to do it now. And I know this because the players that I train are all the best players on their team. And nice. People wonder, how does she score almost every single game? And, you know, because they work way harder than you do.
Yeah, you know, you're exactly right. Players were able to take advantage of the time off to try and work on those things that they've not had the ability to. And I imagine, like, from Adam Oates, holy cow. So I had a front row seat to the Hall & Oates show in St. Louis in the 90s. That was a beautiful little show on ice. I mean, off ice Brett was pretty much like he was during this year's Stanley Cup post parties, drunk and a bit of an asshole. But that's a whole other episode right there. But Oates, oh my gosh, his skills around, you know, his power plays, his shot. Oh my Lord, the way he would shoot that puck and the assists that he gave. What does he impress upon your boys for focus, you know, during their sessions that's different from what you've coached?
My son, he's always looking to see how he can maximize, you know, what he's doing to get to where he wants to be. And that's an everyday player in the NHL. And so he's putting in the time and searching. So he found Adam Oates, and during the Christmas break, the boys were going down there to work with him on the ice for the first time. And I hadn't seen either boy since Labor Day. So if we didn't go down to Florida, my wife and I, we went to see him until the end of the season.
Oh.
So we went down there. So Rem asked me to videotape the sessions. And then we went out to lunch with Adam. And I walked away from that saying that I just met the smartest guy in hockey.
Yeah.
And he just showed me my ceiling. Yeah, I think I'm different than most, and I have a knowledge that most don't have.
Right.
But, and Adam Oates needs guys like me to develop the players to a certain level so they can implement what he's teaching.
Right.
So, but yeah, it's just thinking the game different. And to be honest with you, his number one concern is safety, you know, just not putting yourself in a position to get hurt. And it was funny how he explained it. How I coached and how I was coached is that, let's say someone's going to break a puck out, a winger is going to, defenseman's coming around the net, it's going to make an outlet pass, the winger comes down, kind of J-hooks facing the puck, and then accelerates up the ice. And I was taught that you want to go into a corner and come out faster than you went into it. And Adam's just like, no, that's bad. And so he goes to my son, he goes, Rhett, are you driving yet? And he says, yeah, I'm 18, I'm driving, Adam. And he says, what do you got to do when you get in the car and turn on the key? He says, I don't know, put it in drive. He says, no, you got to be on, because if you're off for 1 second, what happens? He goes, you crash. Yeah, you crash. And he says, that's what your dad did. He would look at the guy that would be off for 1 second, look down, and then he would make the crash, and he'd hurt guys.
Ah.
And, you know, so he teaches patience. He teaches where to go to score goals. And he uses an example of, you know, isn't it interesting how Sidney Crosby or Stamkos or Shifley, whoever, any top player, that it seems almost like every other game, they're sitting on the side of the net, and the puck comes right to them, and no one's around, and they have an easy tap-in. And he shows how that happens. And I didn't know it as a defenseman. I was like, you got to be shitting me.
Right? So now you know, now that's you know how to defend it?
That's how you think the game, but yeah. But it's He is an amazing person, and I told him that he has to protect what he has.
Yeah.
Because it's just him teaching it,
right.
You know? And I said, when Kobe, what happened to Kobe, rest in peace. Yeah. You know, I told him, I says, what if that was you, Adam? I said, I'd be pissed at you right now. And my son would be pissed at you because you haven't shared everything that you got with him yet. So he does an awesome job. And, you know, I'm glad that Rem found him because he's the type of guy that you want to get in front of if you want to see how good you can become at hockey.
Yeah, he was a great player. And, well, you know, he's turned a passion into, you know, a different career post-playing. But I want to talk about yours because yours is so specialized and different. And you started learning it from during your playing career. And then you've really turned it into a science. And I always love when people look at things scientifically and take statistics and data and try and drive things out of it. I just love that. How did you start, you know, Sweet Hockey?
Okay, so Sweet Hockey was a products company that I started. So I was hired by the youth program that my kids played in, Wayzata, to run the Mite program. So I would do, we'd have a Monday night skills session. So I would design the practices and I was doing small station stuff. I had a stick handling station and every other station, the skating, the passing, I was seeing growth and improvement, but stick handling I couldn't, just because we couldn't keep the attention of the kids because these, you know, they're 4 or 5 years old. So I, one night, got in my garage and, you know, got a couple beers going and I took some hockey sticks and pucks and I made a prototype of the first thing. It's called the Sweet Hand Stick Handling Trainer. So imagine lining a row of pucks up in a straight line about, you know, 18 inches apart from each other, elevating those pucks. So let's say do 3 pucks, stack them on top of each other, and then connect them all with a hockey stick on top or a connecting arm. And then you got to navigate the puck through each of the openings while not, you know, lifting your stick up so you don't hit the connecting arm or whatever. So I made like 3 of them after 6 beers and brought them out on the ice and the kids ate it up. And after practice, there's like 3 parents that came up to me asking, where did I get them? And they want to buy one. So I never brought them on the ice again, but long story short, I ended up developing a product called the Sweet Hand Stick Handling Trainer, and Sweet Hockey was developed. That in turn turned into a whole product line, and that company now is called Sniper's Edge Hockey, which my wife and I recently sold just over the last year. But yeah, so we shooting tarp, flooring, pass returner, you know, we were the first ones out there. And then everyone kind of copied what we had done. You got Hockey Shot, I think is a, you know, a copycat. There's X Hockey product who knocked off a few products as well. And, you know, that's part of being in business and, you know, they're a little healthy competition isn't bad, but now there isn't any excuses for players not to be working off ice on their home, you know, on their own in the garage or basement, because it's now an industry. And if you're not doing it, then realize that there are players doing it. And if you have lofty goals, you know, the player that's doing more is probably going to get to where they're going over you doing half of what they're doing.
We've had your products, pass returner and the stick handler, for, I think, two, three years we've had it in our basement and our son's been working on it. So look, you've already been influencing him long before we met you. So that's cool. Well, and then how did that grow into programs that you've developed? I mean, you've mentioned throughout the episode, you know, different things that you've looked at and the study that you did on the puck possession and, you know, the 2002 Winter Olympics and what went on there. How did you make these programs and how do you find the data and the information to continue to build the content to make it more up to date as you go and go and go and everything that you're learning? You don't have to tell your secret sauce, but I mean, just like, how are you keeping it fresh?
Yeah, that's easy. I have players that are coming over that want to get better, and they can't get better if they're going to be learning the same stuff over and over. So I've been continually developing off-ice stick handling shooting drills to feed their appetite and to frustrate them. I mean, I had an Olympian. Her name's Dani Cameronese. I worked with her and her brother for probably, 4 years when she was, probably 13 to 17, around there. Went on to the University of Minnesota All-American and played in the last Olympics, won a gold medal, and she's graduated now, but she's trying to play in one more Olympics. Yeah. So she came back to me. And she gets so frustrated because she can't do a lot of the stuff because it's new to her.
Yeah.
And I just told her the other day, I said, Dani, do you want easy? I can give you easy, but I think you'd be even more mad than you are right now.
Yeah.
She's like, no. So how I got into that is the house that you were at.
Yep.
I wanted to create a space for my boys to be able to shoot and stuff. And at that point in time, I didn't have a program. I wasn't working with players. I wasn't even thinking about that. So we ended up creating that space underneath the garage. We had that built. And the more that I spent time, down there and started, the research that I was doing on how to develop stick skills, off ice was a big part that I learned. Because in Europe has been kicking our butt forever.
Yes.
Until recently, in how to develop stick skills. Like when I was playing, if you asked people that were respected in the hockey world, who's more skilled, European hockey players or North American born hockey players, 100% people would say European. 100%.
Yeah.
I mean, you got the Wayne Gretzky, those guys that'll pump out, but once the Europeans started coming over here, highly, highly, highly skilled.
Yep.
And guess what? They don't have the rinks like we have.
Right.
It would be more like a Nashville setting. There's a few rinks around, but not many. And what they learned to do is how to develop hockey players off the ice. And I even had a guy from USA Hockey admitted that, yeah, we've been slow compared to what they're doing. So I learned that, okay, there's a lot of stuff out there. There's a bunch of DVDs that were out there on sticks handling and shooting development. So I got them all. And, the best coach is also the best thief.
Yeah.
So whatever was out there, I had all that stuff.
Yeah.
And I, in a progression. And then I guess I started doing lessons because it was more than I knew. And it was more than most people knew. So at the beginning, I worked off of things that USA Hockey, Hockey Canada, what I found over in Europe, to train players at my house. And then it just kind of happened. YouTube came out, and all of a sudden, a treasure chest of information and drills that you could see that you never before could. And that just kind of opened up my mind, and I've just started charting everything. If something came into my mind, I'd film it, I'd archive it, and, start piecing together a program. And to where now, and I will say this, that, we were talking about the hard goods products company, that's Sniper's Edge Hockey.
Right.
My off-ice stick handling, shooting, and passing program is called Online Hockey Training. And it currently has... I have over 1,000 drills in my database. I have about 750 of them filmed. My next round of filming will be this fall. And I'm still, coming up with drills. And what's neat is that it's not like I'm in my basement just, here's a good drill, here's a good drill. I come up with this, and when players come over to the house for their lesson, I test it with them and I see how they respond. I see, does it accomplish what I hoped it would? Did they like it? And if all the boxes are checked, it's added to the program. So, and this is, what I've done is I've packaged it in a way that if you don't live in Minnesota and you can't work with me in person, that you can access all the lesson plans that I use with the players that come over to work with me. And it works.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not me saying that it works. All the players that invest in themselves and get these extra shooting and stick handling and passing repetitions accomplish what they want to accomplish. It's fun to see.
It is. And I think one of the other things I want to say about, you've got the 1,000 lessons that are up there. People will be like, oh, well, they'll blow through that in 2 months. No, each lesson you have to do 2, 3, 5 times, and you have to master it before you move on to the next one. You can't just get in this habit of that instant gratification that you mentioned earlier. It's that patience of really getting the muscle memory so that you can translate it from the lesson you're teaching to the ice.
Yep. And that's exactly right. And so there's two parts to the program. The first part is the foundational, and that's where I introduce all the stick handling, shooting, and passing techniques that are available out there. And what's cool is that because I've been doing this so long, I know that I can get players to absorb these new skills quicker if we eliminate movement. So the first part of the program, it's basically in a stationary position. There's a line grid that we go off of. I'm a very visual person, and they plow through that. So I think that one has like 12 training modules. Each one has like 8 to 14 drills on it. Then when they get into the main part of the program, there's another grid that I developed called the Pitlick Stick Handling Grid. Figured if I invented it, might as well name it after myself.
Absolutely. Better than a meteor, right?
But, I get the majority of the drills are done off of that line grid. And what they'll do is they'll do different stick handling patterns, managing 1 puck, 2 puck, 3 pucks, even 4 pucks going forward. And then there's one thing that I know that players love to do, and that's shoot the puck. So if it's not a ball or puck trick, every drill will end with shots and a shot or multiple shots. So you go forward, you take in tight shots, and then they'll do that same pattern walking backwards, ending with shots from far out. And your in tight shot and your shot from far out, completely different techniques. And that's what I teach. So I get players to buy into a couple concepts. One is that they got to become a mega learner.
Yep.
And what my program does, like the main program, the accelerator program, that has 32 different training modules, each one with a minimum of 18 drills. So, yes, I want them to work on each module for a week, doing it, like you said, 3 to 5 times. And each one takes about, maybe 45 minutes to get through, 30 minutes, 45 minutes to get through, which isn't a lot. And then you move on to the next one because, once they get all these skills introduced and, in 17 years of coaching, there's one thing that I learned is that most players use a small set of skills during practices. Mm-hmm. And even that set of skills even gets smaller in games once you add pressure and, everything that goes on with the game. So I skills the crap out of these kids off the ice. I get them doing things with their stick that they never would imagine would be possible. And I don't teach anyone anything that I don't think they're capable of learning. And so they might be doing a cupping exercise stationary. Now we do a moving. Now we do a moving going backwards. Now we throw that cup right into a shot at the end. And it's, I call it layering. So if they commit to it and work the program, that the skills that they use most regularly on the ice in games and practices become super easy. And they say that, when they get the puck in front of the net, things just slow down.
And just as a little verbal testimony here, we spent one session with you last week, and I haven't sent you the video clips yet. And it's not all about goals. I'm not saying that. But what I'm going to say is, our son took that one lesson with you and ended up with a hat trick. He got two shorties and then a breakaway. So both of those you could really see stick handling besides his feet, right?
Yeah.
And I could see a tinge of what you were showing him, specifically keeping his left hand away from his hip. And I have to send that to you to show that just in one lesson. And then he's been obviously in the basement since we've been back this week. He's been doing some of the things, even though we don't have the tape yet to make the grid, but he's been doing things that you've been teaching him. The other thing that I want to give you huge props for is for 14 years, I have pestered my child about drinking water. He will be the kid during practice who will never, ever, ever go over to the bench to take a drink of water. No, he'll be fiddling around with the puck, taking shots instead. I myself, huge water drinker, all I do. Ever since you said to him the importance of water, that child's been walking around with a gallon of water every day and drinking it. So you left two really great lessons with that boy of mine. So I cannot tell you how much I appreciate that. So tell me a little bit, what's the makeup of the players that you work with?
Oh, it's, I guess what's most consistent of them is that they're either very successful already, or I'd say, what blankets them all together is their passion for the sport and their willingness to learn. They want to get better. And I just, when they come work with me or they use the program, they get exposed to a career of development. Mm-hmm. You know, everything that I learned as a player, everything that I learned as a hockey coach, a skills instructor, as a parent of two passionate kids, and a player myself, I pass on. And, you know, why wouldn't you utilize that? I mean, I got all the players that I work with, and you use my boys. This is what I'm passing on to everyone. You know, I'm sharing it.
Yeah.
So if you want to get better, you should, if we haven't met yet or you haven't researched me, you should, because I'm really good at what I do.
Yeah.
There's a book, I don't know if you've ever heard of it. I can't remember if I told you this story, called it's The Talent Code. The Talent Code. So what this guy, what he was interested in is how these remote places around the world were pumping out huge amounts of high-end talent. And it didn't matter what the discipline was, if it was sport, music, art. So he visited what he called these talent hotbeds all over the place, and to see, you know, how were they doing it. And there were three things that kind of came to the forefront that blanketed all of them. One, they had to have a passion for it, because if you don't have a passion for it to keep pushing the needle a little forward, you know, every week, you won't have sustainability to do it for how long it takes to be done. You know, you'll lose interest. The second is they have a different relationship with practice than most people. Mm-hmm. You know, they need that time alone, or to go work with an instructor or whatever. But in most cases, you work with an instructor, you know, take piano. You work with an instructor, then you go home, they give you homework, you go home, you work on that, you come back, good, you did great, now here's the next thing. And that's basically what I do. But they love doing it. They need that to be part of their life. I call it getting the sickness, where you you know, if you don't have a stick in your hand after a couple of days, you feel weird.
Yeah. You're a perfect example of setting your passion. You know, what do they say? If you love what you do, you don't work a day in your life. And you're a perfect example of that. Author of that book, The Talent Code, is Daniel Coyle.
There you go.
Yeah.
So here's the third part. Yeah. So the third part is master coaching. So you got to have passion, different relationship with practice, and you got to find master coaches. So I read that chapter on master coaching when I just got into coaching, you know, like 18 years ago. And I was like, holy cow, this is awesome. I'm going to utilize a lot of this stuff with me as a coach. So now that I, you know, started these businesses and you got to make videos for YouTube and stuff. One of the things I did was a review on the talent code. And so I reread it. And when I read that chapter, the master coaching, when I was just starting out, I was a student. And I reread it probably 7 months ago. And I read that chapter. And I'm like, holy shit, I'm a master coach now.
Yeah.
And I am.
Yep.
I don't need to see a kid shoot the puck to know if he's shooting it properly. If they're struggling learning something new, I can easily extract a drill out of my brain to get them over the hump. But here's what, you'll love this story. About 8 years ago, I started the process of how to teach myself how to stick handle and shoot left-handed. I'm a natural right-hander.
Right.
And why I wanted to do it is because I wanted to see how long it would take if a player, you know, a kid new to the sport or new to what I do, how long it would take for the awkwardness to go away. So for 3 months, I would spend 3 days a week, 30 minutes a session, just doing drills opposite hand. And right around the second week in the third month is where the shift happened and the awkwardness started going away. And now I can't tell when I'm stick handling what hand I am shooting. My wrist can't handle a lot of shooting, so I wasn't able to practice much. But that's one of the techniques now that I use if a kid can't get over the hump, is that if they're struggling, let's say, hitting the top corner with an in tight shot, I'll have them do a couple rounds opposite hand, and then we'll go back to regular hand. And I'm telling you, almost every single time they get over the hump. So that became part of the program. Once they get in the main part of the program, kids are going to have an opposite hand drill or two to do. And again, it's all about mega learning. The more you learn over players, the better you get. It's simple.
Yeah. Well, and you even said it, because my son's a lefty. You're like, okay, I've got to do my left hand. I'll get that out. So it's kind of like learning a new language. Once you're dreaming in it, you've become fluent. So once a kid is dreaming about shooting right, if he's a lefty, he's fluent.
Well, I asked one of my college coaches who's he's a PhD into learning and, you know, all this stuff, you know, the benefits of opposite hand training. And he said, there's a lot of studies that, you know, are going on right now. Nothing's conclusive yet, but he said, there's a lot talking about it. But he said, view it like this, Lance, that if on one side of your brain is your hockey side that you've been doing regular hand, let's say you have a million hockey connections. And all of a sudden on the other side of your brain, you start doing opposite hand stuff, you're going to create 500,000 new brain connections. And then both sides are going to start intermingling. Because I can't see how that doesn't benefit someone. So
right.
That's what I'm going on.
Make that brain bigger. So who's been the biggest surprise athlete that you've worked with? Like the most gain, or someone that you worked with and you're like, and they had a breakthrough and then boom, they're in the Olympics. You mentioned Danny, but who's been your biggest surprise athlete you've worked with?
A couple. There was one, and both of them are girls, and recent, within the last year. So the first one, she was just a unbelievably hardworking, passionate hockey player. I asked her, do you want to play college hockey? I mean, she's working with me a lot and working at home. And she said, you know what, Lance? I decided that I don't want to play college hockey. I have a real passion for painting, but I want to see how good I can be my senior year, you know? And so that was like, all right, she's got her crap together. So I was very impressed with that.
Yeah.
Now the second one, I just had a lesson with her. She knocked my socks off. Just had a lesson with her last week. Her name's Ellie. So I had a lesson with her about a year ago, and that's it. I never saw her again, but I saw her older brother, who's a very accomplished hockey player. Last week, I have a lesson with her. And her mom signed him up separately. So I had the girl first and then the boy second. And she came and I'm like, well, nice to see you again. Have you been practicing? She says, yeah, a lot. Been practicing a lot. All right, now let's get after it. And drill after drill, my jaw just dropped. I mean, her progress in 1 year of working the program, you know, and doing the, it's not just work my program and it's all going to have this, it's all going to come into play. No, you still got to be working with a technical skating instructor. Mm-hmm. You know, you're going to be doing strength training eventually, and yeah. you got to be watching your nutrition. Yep. You know, it's all these extra things, but she really focused on the program, doing probably three hours a week minimum, she said, and she knocked my socks off. So yeah. she hasn't accomplished what she wanted yet, but she knows where she's going. And what's really cool is if I get a 12-year-old, a 13-year-old, and they buy into what I'm doing, they can't see themselves 5 years from now, but I can. And as long as they keep putting in the work, they're going to develop into that player, because most players choose not to do what I do. And if you want to get really good hands, you got to be doing what I'm doing or something like it.
Right. Yeah. Oh, man. That's awesome. So I can attest to your program, especially during lockdown times. You know, my son is in the garage, and it's only been a week that we've been home, not even a week that we've been home, 4 days. He's been down in the garage for an hour to 2 hours every day working on the things that you have taught him that he remembers right now, because we just got the program yesterday. And so he'll start on his modules, you know, today. Yeah. And, but this is something everybody can do. So what's the website? What's it called?
It's onlinehockeytraining.com. And if you want to go to, so that's my membership program. It's accessed everything that I have.
Got it.
If you want to learn more about me, you can go to YouTube, Online Hockey Training. I got all kinds of videos there that I hope that will help players. One you can watch because of the time we're in is how to plan and crush your summer training. Just give players kind of a blueprint that they can follow to accomplish what they want to accomplish. But I got a lot of cool videos that I spent a heck of a lot of time. I mean, there's any video that's over 10 minutes, I have at least 30 hours into that. I mean, you know how much editing takes and all that.
Yeah.
And then you go to Instagram, Online Hockey Training on Instagram, and there's where I highlight the players I get to work with. And what I hope players do is that they see someone the same gender, close to the same age, doing something really cool, and I want them to ask themselves, can I do that? Yeah. And if you can't, get to work.
Yeah.
If you don't want to get to work, then that's who you're competing against. Mm-hmm. If you want a scholarship, that person on Instagram, that's who you're competing against. So if she can do it and you can't, and a college coach is going to pick one of you two, who's she going to pick?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's all great stuff. And I'll be sure to put all of this out on my social media so people can easily access it and make sure we share it. I cannot thank you enough. Absolutely appreciate everything that you've shared with our listeners. And I'm looking forward to seeing a whole lot of good hands coming up this season.
Yeah, no, it's thank you. It's fun, and I'm really passionate about it, and it doesn't feel like work, but I know when a player comes to my house or signs up for the program, you know, if I want a player to work hard for me, they got to know that I'm working hard for them, and I'm in the trenches most days trying to accomplish that. And it's been a fun ride, and it isn't over. A couple of years ago, I almost hoped that the Pitlick drill well would run dry, just because it's just too many balls in the air. But now that I've kind of got my process down and got a good part of the program filmed, you know, I'm glad that it's still churning out some new content. And as long as players keep liking it and signing up as a member, I'll keep trying to pump out whatever I can to help them achieve whatever they're chasing.
That's awesome. Well, and you let your son know if he needs a home cooked meal when he's down here in Nashville, he can come on over. I'm a good cook.
That sounds awesome. So maybe we can do this again sometime. I had a blast. So thank you very much, Julie.
Yeah, no, thank you. And really enjoy your fourth. Happy fourth. And we'll talk soon.
All right. Awesome.